The rest of us are going in our Bibles to Leviticus chapter 18. We're going to go through five chapters this morning in the book of Leviticus. Now, if that sounds painful, the other alternative is to go through each chapter by themselves, okay? So I'm telling you, one is more painful than the other. We're doing it the least painful way this morning. Leviticus chapter 18, we'll be going down through Leviticus chapter 20. As I was working through preparing for this morning, I came upon an illustration of a book entitled My Heart, Christ's Home. You may have been familiar with this, written by Robert Munger. Alan Mosley, one of the commentators that I'm using as I'm working through the book of Leviticus, writes this. Years ago, I read Munger's booklet, My Heart, Christ's Home. Ever since, it's affected the way I think about God's influence in every part of my life. Munger writes, "One evening I invited Jesus Christ into my heart, and what an entrance he made. It was not a spectacular, emotional thing, but it was very real. Something happened at the very center of my life. He came into the darkness of my heart and turned on the light. He started music where there'd been stillness. I said to Jesus Christ, Lord, I want to have you settle down here and be perfectly at home." So Munger goes on to describe his life as a house. The different rooms in the house represent different parts of his life, and he shows Jesus around the house of his life. He starts with the study. Jesus saw what he'd been reading and thinking about, and Jesus replaced that reading material with different books and put different pictures on the wall. Then Munger showed Jesus his living room, and Jesus said, "This is a delightful room. Let's meet here every morning." So he started spending time with Jesus in his living room. Then he showed Jesus the workroom, and Jesus helped him to do better work. When Jesus saw the recreation room, Jesus gave him better ways to spend his free time. There was one room left to show Jesus, but Munger did not want Jesus to see it. The hidden room was a small closet where he kept a few things locked away. He didn't want anybody to know about those things, especially Jesus. But he writes, "With trembling fingers, I passed the key to him. He took it, walked over to the door, opened it, entered, took out all the putrefying stuff that was rotting there, and threw it away. Then he cleaned the closet, and he painted it. It was done in a moment's time. What victory, what release, to have that dead thing out of my life." An idea occurred to Munger. He asked Jesus if maybe he could do in every room of the house what he'd done in that dirty closet. Jesus reminded him he was only a guest in this house. He was not in control of every room. It was at that point that Munger ran to his safe, got the title deed to his house, signed his house over to Jesus, and said, Here it is, all that I am and have forever. Now you run the house. I'll just remain here with you as a servant and a friend." Things are different now since Jesus has made my home, my heart, his home. When we talk about inviting Jesus into our heart, asking Jesus into our heart, it's a phrase that those who are on the inside of Christianity are familiar with. Have you received Christ as your Savior? Have you asked Jesus to come into your heart, to wash away the sin, to take away the putrefying rottenness of your life, and to exchange it with his righteousness? And that's a picture that is good as far as it goes, so long as you understand what it means, asking God to come into your heart. And it's sometimes the picture is disdained, sometimes it's poo-pooed, but it's a picture that's taken from the Old Testament. As we set up this study in the book of Leviticus, we titled it this way: God inhabits the lives of his people. God moves in, if you will, and he does in a very real, literal, in fact, physical way. God had been up on the mountaintop, far removed from his people. Only Moses could go up to that mountain and converse with God. But at the end of Exodus, God comes down off the mountain and resides in the midst of his people. But the command in the midst of this book is that in order for God to inhabit every part of the camp of his people, every part of the lives of his people, they themselves must be holy, because God himself is holy. And unholiness cannot dwell with holiness. And so God says, if I would dwell with you, you must allow me to make every part of your life holy. You've got to give me the keys to your tent, if you will. As we started out this series, the first thing that we highlighted as we consider the book of Leviticus is this. The book of Leviticus requires extensive grounding in context. It's one of the reasons why we went to the book of Leviticus after we did the book of Exodus. Having gotten this much context, it would be almost a waste of time not to plunge into the very next thing that God gives, because that context is so essential to understanding this book. Let's revisit the context for just a moment this morning. We're at Mount Sinai still. It was at Mount Sinai in chapters 19 through 24 where God is emphasizing what holiness looks like. But God says this when he brings them there. He says, I have brought you to myself. Why are we here? We left Egypt and I brought you to this place so that I could bring you to me, to encounter me in my holiness. In chapters 25 through the end of the chapter, through the end of the book, God says, okay, so I've brought you here to me so that I can dwell with you. This is why I brought you here. We're going to the promised land, but before we get there, I needed you to have a rendezvous with me in my holiness, and I want you to understand what it means for you to be my people and for me to be your God. Chapters 25 through 40, he sets up the tabernacle. He sets up the sacrificial system. He sets up the priesthood, and so on and so forth. And God moves in to the camp. But in chapters 32 through 34, there was a problem. It was sin. Yes, God had redeemed his people. Yes, he'd brought them out of Egypt. They had done nothing other than trust in the blood of the Lamb, which they put on the doorposts and over the lintel of their house. They had walked through that door. They had walked under that blood. They were in Christ, if you will, under the blood of the Lamb, so that God could pass over them in judgment. But they were unaware of a problem called sin as a people. Chapter 32, they break the first three of the Ten Commandments. And all of a sudden, they understand sin in a real way. And Moses intercedes on behalf of the people, and God says, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy. But I want you to understand something about me, Moses. Moses asks to see God's glory, and God says, I will show you my goodness. Because Moses, my glory is my goodness. And so he explains a little bit about what it means for him as God to be good. It means, I am who I am. I'm a God who is merciful, a God who's compassionate, a God who's long-suffering, a God who abounds in steadfast love and faithfulness, and I am capable and able to forgive iniquity, transgressions, and sins. But I will not hold the guilty, guiltless. We must deal with that sin. I will forgive it. But those who don't bring it to me to deal with are left with it to deal with themselves. And I'll not count them guiltless if they don't turn over their guilt to me. This is the goodness that God interjects in the middle of this awesome, not even an invitation. He tells them, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to come live with you, even though you're unworthy of it. So in Leviticus chapters 1 through 7, he sets up this whole system of sacrifice. And the purpose of the sacrificial system is to make atonement, so that holy God and sinful man can be at one together. They can be brought together and live in the same context, without the holiness of God consuming his people. Then, In chapters 8 through 10, we see the priesthood set up. And in chapter 10, Nadab and Abihu, they violate God's holiness. They don't do things according to plan. They don't do things according to God's command. And there's consequences. They end up dying. And God says, listen, among those who are near me, I will be sanctified so that before all the people, I can be glorified. He's not just talking about the priests, but he's especially talking about the priests. My people, understand this. Understand this. You are near your God. That means you must count me as holy. And when you count me as holy, I will use you so that others see my holiness. Priests, you in particular, you must. This is a non-negotiable. You must count me as holy. I will be sanctified by those who will draw near to me. Why? Because there's others that are dependent upon your view of your God. You must count me as holy so others can see my glory. If you don't take me seriously, nobody else will. That's chapters 10 and 11. Then he moves into what holiness looks like on a broad scale for the people. Chapter 11, he gives the eating, the dietary laws. He speaks of holiness as a matter of what goes in. That is, what we love. What are our appetites? What are the things that we're hungry for? What are the things that we have to learn to hate? And he's not talking about the physical stuff. He's using physical stuff as a symbol of what our hearts are hungry for. So he says, let me help to instruct your appetites. Because what you learn to intake and ingest will give you the nourishment that you need to live out your life. Then in chapters 12 through 15, he speaks about holiness as a matter of that which comes out. And we see it in the molds that are in the materials, the molds that are in the walls. We see it in a bunch of different illustrations that he gives with personal hygiene and fluids and so on. It's a little gross reading at this time. But his whole point is, I want you to understand that what is inside of you will come out. That is what you are. Jesus speaks of it as trees. By their fruits you shall know them. Can a good tree bring forth bad fruit? No, if it's a good tree, it'll bring forth good fruit. If it's a bad tree, all it can bring forth is bad fruit. What's on the inside will come out. If it's holiness, it'll be holiness. If it's uncleanness, it'll be putrefying, it will be rotting, it will be eating away and sucking the life out of everything in your camp. Leviticus chapter 16, the high Sierras of the Pentateuch. This is the pinnacle. This is the point, the climax of everything. Back in Genesis, man is kicked out of the garden. In Leviticus chapter 16, man presses into the mount of God and enters into his presence once again. Here we see man pressing into God's holiness, but only because of God's goodness. Remember back in Exodus chapters 32 through 34? My glory is my what? My glory is my goodness. My glory is my goodness. Now man presses into the very footstool of God, the very throne room of God on planet Earth. But he doesn't come without invitation. God made the way for him to enter. The way is only this: propitiation. God deals with his righteous indignation against our sin, his wrath. That wrath must be removed. And in the sacrifice that day, the blood that drips, it's sprinkled at the altar. It's put on the horns of the altar. It's sprinkled throughout that sanctuary. God's wrath is removed. There's a second sacrifice. It's non-bloody. after going inside, he goes to the outside and he leans on that scapegoat, confesses the sins of the people, then sends it off on its way into the wilderness. Propitiation is the removal of God's wrath towards man's sin. Expiation is the removal of man's guilt from God's sight. And this is God's goodness toward his people. God does not owe this, my friend, to any of us. God does not owe us to get rid of our sins. But in his goodness, he's provided that for us. That's Leviticus chapter 16. Leviticus chapter 17. Now the priest comes out from the sanctuary, and God's holiness begins to push back out from that holiness center, that command center of holiness, if you will. God's holiness now starts to push back out into his creation. Man forfeited God's holiness, and as the king of God's domain, the whole dominion was brought into the curse. Wherefore, as by one man, sin entered into the world, and death by sin. And so death passed upon all men, in that all have sinned. But now, atonement has been made, and in the very command center of holiness, God's holiness is beginning to break out back into his creation. And we see that when holiness breaks out, creation regains this goodness of God. It starts to function the way creation was created to function. It starts to function according to its design. We go back to chapter 1 of the book of Genesis, verses 27, 28. God says, "Let's make man in our own image." So in the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And he blesses them and says, "Be fruitful and multiply." And man gets to represent God in a real way. When holiness, when man presses into God's holiness presses back out into all of his creation. And so he says in chapter 17, beginning of the chapter, "Now, high priest, go talk to all the people." There's a reverse contagion, if you will. In chapters 12 through 15, we see the uncleanness. Don't touch anything unclean. Why? Because if you touch unclean, you what? You become unclean. If you touch unclean, you become unclean. Here's the thing. Man has pressed into the holiness command center of God. And like the woman with the issue of blood, he's reached out and he's touched the skirts of God. And now, God has taken away the contagion of filth, and he's filled him with his holiness. He's recommissioned him for his purpose in life, to bear God's image inside his creation. And so there's this holiness that's pushing back out from this command center in the center of the camp. We come to this chapter 18 where we're at today, 18 through 22. And there's, again, a theme of God's holiness now pressing out beyond the walls of the tabernacle, out beyond the walls of the courtyard. It's spreading into each tent, into each abode, into each family, into each life, into each moment of each day for all the people of God. And God says this, "You shall be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy." That's the point. And so in 18 through 22, Jeff asked the question this morning, what does holiness look like? Bing, 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 bing. All right. It's like we're taking a baton and passing it. This is exactly the question that we want to answer this morning. What does holiness look like? Because you shall be holy. Because I'm holy. I'm dwelling in your midst. You're dwelling with me as my people. I'm dwelling with you as your God. So you must be holy because I am holy. And this must press out into every arena of life. If we were to look again at the overview of the outline of Leviticus, we'd see that at the very center, in chapter 16 and 17, is the heart, that we the Day of Atonement, where God's holiness and man's sinfulness intersect in a very real, tangible way. At the outside of the book, we see that there's rituals, both in 1 through 7 and then 23 through 27. There's sacrifices, there's certain things that have to be done, and they have to be done certain ways. In chapters 8 through 10, we saw already, there's a priestly emphasis. In chapters 21 through 22, there's a priestly emphasis. And here on either side of the center of the book, there's kind of a common core of purity that's not just for priests or even especially for priests. It's for everybody. Everybody who wears the name of this holy God must be pure in these ways. What we're going to do today is we're going to take chapters 18 through 20, which are purity laws for everybody, and we're also going to take chapters 21 and 22, which are purity laws just for the priests, and we're going to slam these two sections together into one. Again, I hope you understand why as we get done with this section. God's holiness is witnessed in these two realms. In chapters 18 through 20, God's holiness is witnessed in the lives of every one of God's people. Let's go to chapter 18. You're there. Leviticus 18, verse 1. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God." As we get into the middle of this, at the very beginning of this section, we're going to see in verses 1 through 5 of chapter 18, and then at the very end of this section for the people, the common people, verses 22 through 27 of chapter 20, that God is going to kind of give us two passages that kind of give us a broad sweep over why he's saying what he's saying at this time. They're parameters that he's drawing on the people. The first is this. We read it already. Verse 2, "Speak to the people of Israel, say to them, I am the Lord." What's the next two words? "Your God." This is who I am. I am the Lord your God. If we were to go up to chapter 20, we would see that he says, verse 26, "You shall be holy to me. I have separated you from the peoples so that you should be mine." I'm yours. You're mine. This theme echoes what God said back in Exodus chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. I'm going to redeem you as a people so that I can be your God and you will be my people. God puts these as bookends over this section. Why do I have to be holy? It's a good question. It's a fair question. Why can't I just live life the way I want to live life? Why can't I just answer to myself? The reason is this. It's twofold. One, I am your God. I can tell you what to do. Number two, you belong to me. You are my people. Again, these themes are echoed in the New Testament. What? Know ye not that your body is the temple? It's the tabernacle of the Holy Ghost, which is in you, which you have of God. And you what? You are not your own. That's a foreign concept, not just to us as Americans, but especially to us as Americans. You are not your own. Why do I have to be holy? Because I am not my own. I belong to God, and God belongs to me. In fact, he uses his name there. I am Yahweh. I am who I am. I am the living God who exercised my strong arm and got glory over Pharaoh. I exercised my strong arm and brought judgments on the gods of the Egyptians. You know who I am. Now, because you know who I am, understand, I'm yours and you're mine. That's why you must live this way. He says further, my statutes are life. Other statutes are death. We're in chapter 18, verse 2. Speak to the people of Israel. Say to them, I am the Lord your God. Verse 3, you shall not do as they do in the land of Egypt where you used to live. And you shall not do as they do in the land of Canaan, to where you're going, the land to which I'm bringing you. Both behind you and before you, you have really, really, really bad examples of how to live life. You shall not walk in their statutes. Verse 4, instead, you shall follow my rules and keep my statutes and walk in them. Why? Because I am the Lord your God. And because I'm your God, therefore you shall keep my statutes and my rules. But here's the thing. If a person does them, he shall live by them. And in case you didn't make the connection, I am the living God. I am. I really am. Where other gods aren't, I am. And so I, who am life, promise to give you life if you live life by my rules. He calls them in this passage statutes. There's several different words that God could have chosen: commands, rules, precepts, judgments. He calls them statutes. The idea of statutes is the idea of a lawgiver setting up laws for a stable household. Okay? These are the rules of my house. Or the laws for a stable citizenry. The laws for a stable nation. Okay? God says, here's the way we're going to do life together. These statutes, they bring life. But they don't just bring life to you. They bring life to you in the context of us together. It's more than just me and my God. It's me living life before my God in the context of others. And God says, if you learn to live life this way, this household, this nation, this citizenry, this society will begin to reflect the way I've created it to be. These are the defining parameters. Up in Leviticus 20, he says, therefore you shall keep my statutes, do my rules. The land that I'm bringing you to live in, won't vomit you out if you live this way. If you choose to live by their statutes, it's so bad, the land is, it's sick. It's sick because their ways bring death. He's going to bring us to one of the cults eventually, the cult of Molech, a god who was in charge of the underworld, the realm of the dead. There was the worship of ancestors, the worship of the dead involved with Molech. It was committing their children to the fires of Molech, child sacrifice, a god of death, who epitomized the antithesis of the ways of life brought by this living God. He says, listen, you have two options. You can either live by the statutes of the people who surround you, both in front and behind, Egypt and Canaan. That's your option. Option number one, let me tell you where it leads. It leads to the grave. Okay. Option number two, you can cling fast to me. You can hold fast to me. You can learn about me, and you can find by obedience that everything I'm telling you is all about life. It's for your good. And I become the channel, the conduit of life itself for you. This is the parameter that he's setting up. He says, now listen, I want you to understand. You are holy to me. You are special to me. You are my segola, he had said. You are my special citizenry. You will function in a special way. You are near to me. You stand between me and the people. I had promised Abraham, Father Abraham, back in the day, that in you all nations on earth will what? Will be blessed. Okay, understand. You have a special role. You have a special function. You are near me. Therefore, you will sanctify me so that I will be glorified to others. You're special. You're not like the Egyptians. You can't live like them because you're not like them. You can't live like the Canaanites. You can't live like them because you're not like them. At your very core, you're something different. You're my people. Chapter 18, verse 6. Now, none of you shall approach any one of his close relatives to uncover nakedness. Oh, here we go. So here's one of those fun sections in the book of Leviticus. If you read through it, you find the word nakedness in there about a dozen different times. Wow, do I have to be reading this? As God begins to help his people understand what holiness is and the special role that they play as the people of God, basically what he drives home for them is this, is you will be holy in your homes. Yes, you'll be holy when you come to me at the tabernacle. You'll bring your sacrifices. They're going to be perfect, without blemish, without spot. They have to be done a certain way. But listen, I'm not just interested in holiness when you come to church. You know where I'm really interested in holiness? Not even just in your home, where you entertain your guests there in the living room. You know where I'm interested in holiness? In your bedroom, where the door is shut. I'm interested in holiness in that closet where the key is locked. I'm interested in holiness where nobody sees. You know why? He selects and isolates their sexuality. Why? Because it's in this intimacy, this coming together of man and woman, that the image of God is uniquely portrayed. God said, this is my image, male and female. And as they come together as one, it's something fuller than just a man. It's something fuller than just a woman. There's a coming together. And he says, do you want to understand what I'm like? How do I say Trinity? They don't even understand what that means. It's a little bit like one person pouring themselves into another person and a third person being involved in the mix. He says, you want to understand me? Let me give you just a little bit of a picture. It's like man, woman, offspring, one flesh. He says, you know what? There's not a place in your life that I don't want to reclaim. And the thing that I want to reclaim most is one of the most precious gifts I ever given. You ever gotten a gift that you don't know what to do with? You unwrap it and you're like, wow, that's interesting. What do I do with that? Used to watch Holiday and the old Bing Crosby flick with my mom and dad right around Christmas time. Fred Astaire and Bing Crosby gets out of show business. He goes and lives on this hobby farm. He opens up a ski lodge in Vermont, and he puts up peach preserves, and he comes back and he visits his buddy Fred Astaire there on Broadway. He says, here's some peach preserves. And Fred grabs him and says, yeah, that's great. Those go great with just about anything. He's like, what am I supposed to do with this? In our sexuality, God has handed over the keys to not peach preserves. He's given us the keys to, like the one girl got, the $1 million Ferrari from her dad. Dad hands over the keys to the $1 million Ferrari. He says, listen, this is something very, 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 very special. And it's yours. And we, like that young lady, take out the car for a test drive. 210 miles an hour. She hits a utility pole. Flip, flip, flip. By God's grace, she walks away with minor bruises and two cuts. But you know what? God hands us the key to a grand gift and says, listen, this is yours. But I want you to understand, here's how you use it. And so in chapter 18, he talks, verse 6, it's not to be used in the close proximity of your home with anybody other than your spouse. One man, one woman for life. So don't use it in these other realms. And he lists several different realms in which it's not to be used. Don't take this person. Don't take that person. Don't. Why? Because they're close relatives. It's incestuous. Rather than ministering to each other in the home, you're consumed with taking from and pleasing yourself. He said, that's not what I created the home to be. The home is the center of holiness. The home is the center of service. The home is the center of giving, of ministering, not of taking for myself at the expense of others. He uses some words. He comes down to verse 17. He speaks of a certain kind of sexual sin, taking both a woman and her daughter, taking a woman and her children or her grandchildren, and using them sexually. He said, listen, you don't do this, and here's why. Their relatives, at the very end of the verse 17, it says, this is depravity. The word is infamy. This will give you a bad name publicly. This is fame in all of its wrong ways. This will make you known, but it will make you known for all the wrong reasons. This will put you out in the eye of the public. But everything they say about you when you live like this will be for bad, not for good. It's shame. It's extreme dishonor. You can't live this way. I've designed you for glory. I've designed you to bear my name. I've designed you to reflect me. All people will see when you live this way is garbage and putrid and be ready to vomit you out. Don't live like this. Then he starts to list in verse 19 down through verse 23 other different things. He had talked about back in chapter, I guess it was chapter 15, about when a woman is going through her period and the menstruation. He says that now that's a part of life. It happens, okay? If it happens, you're unclean for a time. He says, now listen, don't you pursue sexual gratification knowing that it will make you unclean. Don't do it on purpose. Don't pursue pleasure when you know that it puts you in jeopardy in your relationship with me. Don't do that on purpose. And so he spends a verse talking about that. But his whole point is this. Don't make yourself unclean on purpose. Don't do it. Your whole life is meant to be about cleanness, not uncleanness. So don't pursue it. Yes, it happens, but don't make it happen. Don't make yourself unclean. Verse 20. He talks about adultery. Now this is a woman that isn't a close relation, but she's still off limits because she doesn't belong to you. Verse 21, he talks about the offspring. So you bring forth a child, which is meant for life and the continuation of life and the continuation of blessing. Don't give it to the God of death. It's like the antithesis of everything I've created you for. Verse 22, homosexuality. In no uncertain terms, he says, don't do it. Don't do it. And then he says, here's why. Because it is an abomination. Earlier we saw it's a depravity. A depravity, that which makes you known for all the wrong reasons. This is an abomination. The idea is that it's faulty, it's corrupt, it's polluted. It's aberrant, therefore it's abhorrent. It's bad, therefore you must hate it. It's ugly, it's repulsive. God says homosexuality is not a beautiful thing. It's an ugly thing. It's not the way it's supposed to work. In fact, it makes me sick, and it should make you sick as well. He comes down to verse 23. Don't take this beautiful God-imaging gift of intimacy, of two becoming one, and don't become one with an animal. And again, it's to say these things out loud, Paul says, we don't even want to speak about these things. They're shameful. But understand this. This is what's happening in Egypt. This is what's happening in Canaan. And he says, this is what their view of life is. I'm telling you, I made you for something better than this. You're different. You're different than animals. You reflect me. You cannot do this. And he says, this is a perversion. This is confusion. This violates the divine order. This messes up the design. You can't live like this. He says in chapter 18, listen, you shall not do this. Verse 26, you shall keep my statutes. You shall keep my rules. Don't make yourselves unclean by any of these things. Because, verse 27, the people of the land who were before you did these abominations. They did all of these abominations. And the land itself became unclean. Don't you do it, verse 28, so that the land doesn't vomit you out when you make it unclean. Verse 29, for everyone who does any of these abominations, the person who does them shall be cut off from their people. The idea is you'll be cut off from my people. This isn't how my people live. If this is how you choose to live, that's up to you. But you can't be my people. You can't wear my name and live like this. It just doesn't happen. Chapter 18, a difficult chapter, but God is saying this. Holiness begins in the home. It's cultivated in private. Guys, what are you looking at on your computers? What are you visiting on your phones? When you're standing in line at the checkout counter, where are your eyes gazing? You know what? If you haven't determined in your heart, like Daniel did, to be pure, your eyes are going to fall on the wrong thing. I know they will. Guard your heart with all diligence, for out of it comes every going forth, every issue in life. Holiness begins in the home. Chapter 19. Holiness then spreads out into the community. It's revealed by love. He says to Moses in chapter 19, verse 1, speak to all the congregation and say, you shall be holy, for I am holy. Let's talk about what this looks like. And he says, it comes down to verse 3, every one of you shall revere his mother and his father. That's commandment number 5. The first four commandments, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Don't make any gods. Number 3, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Number 4, the Sabbath day is holy unto me. Four commands dealing with man and God, vertical. Number 5 begins all the horizontal ones. Honor your father and mother. Don't lie. Don't steal. Don't commit adultery. Don't give false witness. So on and so forth. He takes the very first of the horizontal commands, and then he starts working backwards. And keep the Sabbath. And remember, it's Yahweh, it's my name that you people wear. So don't do idols, because I'm your God. No other gods. But what he does in these first 5 verses here at the very beginning of chapter 19 is he says, listen, all of these horizontal commands are based on these first 4 vertical commands. Here's why you have to live this way in relation to each other. The second is like unto it. Love your neighbor as yourself. If in fact I'm your God, if in fact I'm your God, then this is what you owe to everybody that you do life with, beginning with your parents. But he wants you to understand, listen, all of these laws have their foundation in these laws. And so he comes down to verse number 5. When you offer a sacrifice, do it this way. And he's speaking of a sacrifice, a peace offering. It's a gratitude gift. It's a thanksgiving offering. He says, good, good. So we're starting out this relationship right here. Now, if this relationship is right, down to verse 9. So, you say you're thankful. You say you're grateful for my grace, my mercy in your life. Then I want you to be gracious to others. Don't plow. Don't reap up to the edge of your fields. Leave something for the poor. Leave something for the sojourner. If, in fact, you are grateful for my grace, learn to be gracious and generous to others. He comes down to verse 11. If, in fact, we're right, we're close, we're like this, you and me, then you must, verse 11, you must be honest. You can't take from others. You can't steal from others. You can't deal falsely with them because, end of verse 12, I'm God. I'm Yahweh. I'm this kind of a God. Verses 13 and 14, if in fact we're like this, yeah, then you must have sympathy on those who are less fortunate than yourself. You will not take advantage of people by cursing somebody who can't hear what you say, by sticking your foot out in front of somebody who can't see you. You will not take advantage of others. In fact, you won't even keep the coat of somebody who doesn't have enough money and has borrowed from you just for their basic needs. You've got to give them their coat back at night. You've got to learn to feel others' pain. You've got to empathize and sympathize with them. Verses 15 and 16. You will not do injustice when it comes to others. You won't lie about them. You won't prefer them. You won't prefer one above another. Right is right is right, no matter who is standing before you. Why? Verse 16, I am the Lord. Verses 17 and 18, you will learn to forgive. You will not hate. You will not bear a grudge. You will go talk to that person. You'll confront them. You'll rebuke them. You'll have it out in words, civilly. You have to talk to each other about it, so that this doesn't grow into something bigger than that. There's a section we're not going to deal with, verses 19 down through 31, 32. You shall stand up before the gray head. You will honor the face of an old man. Why? You shall learn to fear your God. You will find your place, your place of humility. Verses 33, 34. You will show mercy toward others. Remember that you yourself were a stranger, and I was merciful and compassionate and feeling toward you. Verse 36, 37, 35 through 37. In measures of length, in weight, in quantities, you won't take advantage of others. You will have integrity. Just weights, just balance. Listen, verse chapter 19, we have it right down at, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. This is why you're doing these things. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Why? Because I am God. If in fact this relationship is what it's supposed to be, then these relationships matter. They matter a lot to me because I'm your God. Chapter 20, holiness in the land. We're about out of time. Chapter 20, he says, listen, you will not pursue the god of death. Molech is his name. You will not bow down to him. You will not worship him, because wrong worship equals a wrong walk. If you worship the god of death, your life will look like death. If you worship the god of impurity, your life will look like impurity. It just works that way. You can't seek out the necromancers, the people who try to get in touch with the dead. I'm giving you all the revelation you need, and everything I say is for your life. It's for your good. It's for your benefit. He comes down to the middle of the chapter, verse 10. So if man commits adultery with his wife of his neighbor, and he starts to revisit some of those sins back in chapter 18, he says, they must die. They must die. They must die. They must be burned with fire. Probably after they'd been stoned, just to remove the putridness of the filth from the community. They must die. He says, listen, folks, understand, I'm the Lord your God. You are my people. Because I'm holy, you must be holy. You must live by my statutes, even though you're going to be tempted to live by the statutes of everybody who surrounds you, both in front and in back. But you can't do that. You've got to cultivate holiness in the home. That holiness has to spread out into the community. and it's got to reach out into the whole land. And if we don't get a hold of it, here's what we got to do. We got to cut it off. We've got to remove it. Otherwise, what happens? I must remove you. You've got to deal with sin. So Jesus, it's in this context, it's in this background, Jesus says, listen, if your eye offends you, do what? Pluck it out. Remove it. If your hand offends you, do what? Cut it off. Get rid of that member so that the rest of your life can be sound, can be whole. We move up to chapter 21 and 22. We won't go through it as slowly as we have the others. God's holiness has to be seen in every one of his people, but it especially must be seen in every one of God's leaders. As I was going through this, just about every commentary said, because God holds his leaders to a higher standard. That's false. God holds his leaders to the same standard that he holds every one of his people. But he holds them to a tighter judgment. So he says, don't strive to be many masters. Don't strive to be many teachers. Because you need to understand that there is a stricter judgment for those who say that you must walk away this way and don't. If in fact you're telling others, this is how you're supposed to do life, then you better be doing life this way. It's not a different standard. There's just a stricter judgment. And God says, for all who come near, I must be sanctified so that through you I will be glorified. Here's the thing. Every one of God's people were called to be a priestly people. And so he says, of my priests, here's what I want from them. Chapter 21, the first half, it starts to talk about funerals for the regular priest. Then it talks about marriages for the regular priest. Then it talks about funerals for the high priest. Then it talks about marriages for the high priest. Here's the deal. In their funerals, the priest couldn't defile himself with the dead unless they were very, 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 very close. Mom, dad, wife, children. Maybe a sister and a brother. Depend on if she was married or not. Okay. But everybody else, you don't make yourself. In fact, high priest, you can't do it at all. You can't be a part of the funeral. You can't touch them ever. Why? He says, verse 6, chapter 21, verse 6, and this is one of the first times where he introduces this phrase, they shall be holy to their God and not profane my name. You see, how they respond to their sorrow gives an impression to others about how big a deal this is. Is death big? Huge. But is it all-consuming? No. Why? Because I am the resurrection and the life. He says, priests, you shall sorrow not as those who have no hope. I want you to exemplify for a whole community. I want you to make holy my name by providing hope in the midst of sorrow. He talks about their weddings, sanctifying God's lineage through intimacy. You understand that the priesthood was passed from father to son, from father to son, from father to son. There were no outsiders allowed in. So he says, you can't marry somebody who's had an outside relationship and bring them in. There's a contamination factor there. In fact, with the high priest in particular, he says, you must marry a virgin, one who's never, ever, ever, ever had anybody else. Why? Because your lineage. I want you to preserve, I want you to evidence what a holy marriage looks like. One man, one woman for life. In bringing forth a holy fruit, a holy people. He says in chapter 21, verse 23, and he gives a whole list of things that they can't. Verse 16, whoever has a blemish, if he's blind, lame, a mutilated face, a limb too long, so on and so forth, he can't serve me. If he has a handicap, okay? Not because people with handicap are bad. He could still eat the holy things. But here's what he says. I want you to understand that all these pictures that I'm putting in place for the priest who serves in my holy place, they represent a God who's perfect. And so they have to be perfect specimens of what I've created life to be. It's not that they're dirty, defiled. It's just I can't use them in this capacity because they're symbolic. I'm using them in a special way at this time. And that doesn't follow through in the New Testament, but he's using this picture in the Old Testament. The idea is there's a soundness. When God takes us, he puts our lives together in a way where everything works. And it works the way it's supposed to. In chapter 22, in their worship, sanctifying God's charge, he said, "You will not profane my charge by being impure in your worship. You will sanctify, you will not profane my offerings by giving it to anybody to eat. Only people who are holy eat what is holy to me." Chapter 22, he speaks of the perfection of all of their offerings. "You will bring me what is perfect." Perfect. You are the gatekeepers. Understand this. As leaders, in your sorrow, in your rejoicing, in your weddings, in your physique, in your worship, in your eatings, in your offerings, everything you do has the possibility of sanctifying me. Everything you do has the possibility, he actually says it in the reverse, of profaning me. Of taking this holy God and making me common in the sight of others. You can't do it. Let's come down to chapter 22, the end of this section. It's the priestly section, but it's still the holiness of God's people. We come down to the end of this section, and there's just three verses. Verse 31, 32, 33. "In this way you shall keep my commandments and do them, because I am the Lord. You shall not profane my holy name, so that I may be sanctified among the people of Israel." Priests, you will treat me as holy so that others see me as holy. My people, you will treat me as holy so that a watching world will see me as holy. You shall not profane my name. He uses this reasoning, this line of reasoning in this chapter six different times. Listen, it's my name at stake in you. It's my name at stake in your holiness. It's my name that's at stake in the way you choose to live. Don't take my name and defile it. This is the third commandment. Thou shalt not take God's name in vain. Christian, if you wear God's name and you live like the devil, you're breaking that third commandment. You shall be holy because you wear my name. He says there at the end in verse 33, "I am the Lord who sanctifies you, who brought you out of Egypt in order to be your God." Redemption. I've brought you out. I've named you as my own. I've claimed you to be mine. I've given myself to you. I've brought you here to myself so that I can live with you, so we can be one. He's using beautiful marriage terminology, and when they walk away from him, he speaks of it as if it were adultery. He says, "This is what I've created you for me, and I'm giving myself to you." The way we've worked through things here at Valley View, we've built it into our motto, knowing God through His Word so that we can show God to His world. This is what we're about, okay? It's knowing God. It's looking up. It's loving God, bowing down. It's being who we're supposed to be, plugging into this people of God so that we can reach out and others can see not us, but God in us. This is what it means to be God's people. And it works from top to bottom. You can't love God if you don't know God. And you can't do what's right if you aren't right from the inside. Because what's inside must come out. This is who we are. This is how we do church. But it's never two things that are separate. It's always one thing. Because we know God, we love God. Because we love God, we're changed by God. Because we're changed by God, we do different things than the people that are around us. We are a different people. And he says in 1 Peter chapter 2, you are a holy people so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who's called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. And you can see in our logo there, we've got the darkness on the one side of the cross. And after we've come to the cross, we come into the light. That's the whole purpose. If God has changed your life, then let others see the light of God in you. Jeff talked a little bit about holiness. This desire, this thirst for experiencing God. Truth and goodness and beauty are related. Truth is the truth of who God is, I am. When I get how good God is, He changes me and makes me good so that His beauty shines out. It fits. It works the way it's supposed to. And when I live life this way, as a disciple of God, in light of the truth of God, changed by the goodness of God, and reflecting the beauty of God, I touch another life. And God brings the truth into their life and changes them and changes their life so that they reflect the beauty of God and touch another life and touch another life and touch another life. God says, listen, you have to make holiness your priority. This is an ermine. They're found in the forests, especially in Ireland, I take it. But as I was reading about this guy, he has a pure white fur. They will do anything to keep their fur white. In fact, those who trap them don't set traps. They find where an ermine lives, and they go to the entrance of his house, and they smear it with pitch and tar and dirt and smudge all around the entrance to his hole. Then they release their dogs to go find the ermine. The ermine will start running back to his den, and as soon as he gets there, he looks at that den, and he sees that there's filth all around his den. He says, you know what? Just can't do it. And rather than diving in that den at the expense of dirtying his coat, the ermine will turn around and face the dogs, and he will die rather than become dirty. You know what? For an ermine, purity is of greater value than life itself. Folks, for God's people, holiness must be of greater value than life itself. Why? Because God made Christ to be sin for us who knew no sin, so that in Christ we can become what? The righteousness of God. God takes your ugly, broken, defiled life. He breathes His Spirit into it as the blood of Christ is applied to it. And He puts all those pieces back in place. And He says, now I can use you for what I designed you for in the first place, so that we can be the righteousness of God in Him, so that men can see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. That's the purpose. It's never just about me. It's sanctifying my God so others can see His glory. How are you doing at that today? That's what the book of Leviticus is about. You be holy because your God is holy. Let's pray.